I was not sure why Al invited me originally, and now I'm not really not sure. I told him when he had asked me if I would be a resource to the committee that's done some of the legwork for this, if I would be a part of that, and I wrote him a memo saying no, I couldn't because I didn't know enough. And he thought I was kidding, you know, but it's true. You'd find that out maybe by the time I get through here. But you know what I really thought was this. If what I learned about leadership was right, and if I did what was right, which I didn't always, but doing the same thing would not get the same result. Because the big issue was that God helped me. And that's my text for tonight, 2 Chronicles 26:5. King Uzziah, he sought the Lord in the days of Zechariah, who had understanding in the visions of God, that's King James, and as long as he sought the Lord, God made him to prosper. Now, I realize that you've had 3 days of heavy and good material. So what my little books on public speaking tell me, or my notes are, go easy on the last night. No new material, but your job is to strengthen what we already believe. So you don't need to take extensive notes here. I'll also admit this, a little preliminary here. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways, and I'm unstable in all my ways. As I was preparing for tonight, I couldn't decide between two messages. Got them both here. Talking around the table with the guys with whom I ate tonight, I decided that it was one of the messages. And as Terry introduced me, I decided it's another one. So I won't tell you which is which, but this is the another one. And my topic is, what makes a successful leader and why do some hit the skids? And we're going to use Uzziah and this chapter as our reference to highlight some points there that give us some thought. This is not intended to be inclusive, well-rounded, just some thoughts tonight as you wind up your 3 days together. Now, Uzziah became king at age 16, you remember, just to refresh your memory. He was king for 52 years. And he was greatly prospered. He became very strong. And very powerful. Then he hit the skids. He lost it all. He lost his kingdom. He lost his people. He lost his health. He lost his palace. And he died in an isolated house. Well, what made him a success, and why did he hit the skids? What made him a success? 3 things. And as I said, this I intended tonight to be a little lighter. And prompters, reminders. But the first thing that I want to say about him, he sought God in the days of Zechariah, who, according to the NIV, instructed him in the fear of God. So the first thing that made him a success, he had a mentor. Now, my mentor, of course, starting out in the Navigators, was Doss Trotman. Doss taught me to seek God. He didn't preach on seeking God or talk about seeing God. We sought God together. And I learned to seek God from him. But I didn't really learn leadership. I don't even recall his ever preaching on leadership. In fact, I can remember very little of what he said about leadership. I remember one day, I was 28, I remember, and I'd been made vice president of the Navigators. I can see it now because encounters with Dawson had a way, some of them particularly, leaving a lasting impression. So I can remember the time and the place, riding in a car across Arizona with some other guys in a gospel team. And he and I are the only ones awake. He's driving, and I'm talking to him. And I said, Dawson, now that I'm vice president, what's my job? What are my duties? Oh, he said, we don't give a man a title and a job to do. We give him a job to do. It's absolutely necessary. We give him a title. End of discussion. Well, I know we need titles, but I haven't been big on titles since that trip across Arizona. Oh, he used to. The other thing I can remember is saying that he always felt the two heads was a monstrosity. Well, I believe in leadership teams, but I, ever since that, don't believe in team leadership. But, so when he died, I really had a scramble. And I had a scramble all of my career on leadership. I did not have a philosophy of leadership that I could follow. I'd run up against something and I'd scramble for it. But the Lord had people all along the way, like I'm sure he has for you. The very day Doss died, I was with the Graham team in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Rod called me on the phone in the hotel room, told me that Doss had drowned. I got up and I went out in the hall to find somebody. The first person I met was Billy Graham. And when I told him, I'll never forget what he said. He said, oh God, I want to rededicate myself. That was his instant reaction. So he said to me, why don't you stay here? Don't go home this afternoon. Stay through the meeting tonight. And we'll ride down to Oklahoma City together. Because this was Monday night. In those days, they had an off night on Monday nights. And they'd go to some other city to have a crusade on that night. So we went back to Oklahoma City. On the way back, he said to me, among other things, he said, now what you've got to do, Lauren, is take your gifts and get out in the battle. He said, one of the first things I think you ought to do is take a trip around the world. You've got to have a world vision. So the next year, Rod Sargent and I did that. We took 3 months on a trip around the world. Well, I got home here, and then I flew back to Scroon Lake, where they hadn't yet found Dawson's body. And I got there. Next day they discovered it. Well, there was a man by the name of R.E. Thompson who was a China Inland Mission missionary from Ireland, a veteran. He had come to Scroon Lake to talk to Dawson about the missionary internship they were setting up in Detroit as a place where they could orient our missionaries because we were going to go into the missionary work. Our business. But Doss died before they could talk. But I know God had that man there for me. Because I can see it yet that night. We were at Scroon Lake, in front of the hotel, sitting in the car. He said, now, Lauren, there are three things you've got to do. First, you've got to take proper care of Lila, his widow. For her sake and for everybody who's watching. The second thing you've got to do, you've got to form a team. This was getting ahead of Dawson. He didn't have a team. You've got to have a team. So I did. I said about that later. And the third thing, he said, whenever you get up, you've got to have something fresh from the Lord. Great advice, wasn't it? And let's see, that'll be 40 years ago this summer. I've never forgotten that. And then you know what he did? I may have mentioned to a few, but very few people knew this or know it. He came out here and spent the rest of the summer, the Glen, staying over here in the place next to Echo Rock. What do you call it? The little cabin, not the pink house, the little one. And he was there just to mentor me. Never showed up at the office, stayed there. And then when I needed something, I'd call him and I'd go out and meet him on the lawn somewhere. All summer long. Thank God for mentors. But as I said, I was scrambling for help. And you know, one of the most helpful books in those early days was Dwight Eisenhower's Crusade in Europe. Now, I can hear somebody say, oh, that's, yeah, I thought so. He used the military model. Well, it's all right. But not everybody thinks so. But I learned a lot there on how he went about getting different nationalities to work together. And that was the coming thing in our work in those days. But I also learned another thing I remember, and that is to never adopt wholesale anything from anybody, but always adapt. Because unless you adapt, you haven't thought it through. You may end up with virtually the same thing, but just make it a policy, never adopt how good it sounds from anybody, but always adapt to your and your situation. And that became a guideline for me all my life. Very big help. Well, another mentor, of course, are your people that you work with. I think of Jim Downing. Now, Jim Downing retired from the service to come and help me. Up till that time, he didn't think the navigators needed him. But when Doss died, he took a look at me and realized that the navigators needed him. And this humble man retired. He was in his early 40s. And I was 35. He came and was my assistant for a lot of years. I may have told some of you, Jim has the retreats here at the Glen about every other summer of these old timers. Of course, it's diminishing in number, but it's really an exciting time. But I go over to them, and there hasn't been a time that I can remember that some one of the old timers didn't come up to me and say, "Now, Lauren, you know, when Doss Trotman died, we all thought that Jim Downing ought to have been president." I said, well, they were probably right, but here we are. But Jim saved my life, literally. Well, I remember one day, he hadn't been with me too long, maybe 6 months, a year. He said, "Lauren, let's go for a ride." We've never happened before or since. I didn't realize how important that was until we got over there by Echo Rock, and he gave me a lecture. He said, "You haven't got a vision. You're not going anywhere." God said, "Well, we're not going anywhere. You got to get a vision." Well, I've never forgotten that one either. And that became just part and parcel, warp and woof of my being. A vision. I also realized how hard it is to get visions across. But a vision having to do with movement. Where are we going? Why are we going there? And how are we going to get there? I learned that from a mentor, Jim Downing, and many other things as well. I was over in Korea, and I had lunch with a missionary who was a professor in the seminary of a well-known missionary family of Korea. And you know, until I looked at you, Roger, I don't know if you remember, but I can't for the life of me remember the name of that missionary. Successive generations. But at any rate, no, it was somebody else. No, it was with the Presbyterians. But anyway, I don't think it was. I wish it had been, because I liked to meet Sam Moffat from what I've heard of him. But I had lunch with this gentleman like I always did. I took my journal along. And just unabashedly, just picking people's minds everywhere I went because I was desperate for help. And I remember he said to me, now, Lauren, in a work like you've got and growing like it is and where you're going, you've got to have two things absolutely clear. You've got to have an absolutely clear sense of purpose and absolutely clear lines of authority. Now, I think navigators probably agree on the first, but not so much on the second. But it was a great help to me. Well, I could go on, but mentors, aren't you grateful for mentors? Picking people's brains. I had a great desire to go to seminary. And even after I was president of the navigators, I still wanted to go to seminary. Talked to Billy Graham about it. Talked to John Stott about it. And then I picked up from Billy. He was always picking people's brains. I call it scrambling because I needed help so much. Well, as the years went along, I felt we needed a task force on biblical leadership. So Doug Sparks headed that up. And Al Andrews was a part of that task force. And Al came up with something that you've heard about, I'm sure, that biblical leadership, or the three dimensions of biblical leadership, which Al said are servant, steward, and shepherd. Well, when I first heard that, I thought, no, too slick. I mean, it can't be that good. It can't be that smooth, that slick. Because haven't you learned... You've heard something that sounds really smooth, really slick, and after a year or two, something dawned on you that there was something wrong with it. And so you kind of get a little skeptical about something that sounds too good. Others say, well, you know, soldier, student, we've got to add more S's to this. Well, I've many times, through a lot of years, I've thought about those three. I think that Al put together three things that are a unit in themselves. And it's well balanced as to what spiritual leadership is. So, I said at the beginning, this isn't a night for something new. This is a night to reinforce what we already know. But I'm going to hang the rest of what I have to say on Al's outline. Steward, or rather servant, steward, shepherd. Now, what do they say, the judge say, when there's somebody who said something that doesn't belong on the record? Strike it. Strike that. And it's not due to my age, it's due to the imposing audience that I have, that I'm not going to speak on this, Al, except now that I brought it up. What am I going to do? I got the introduction from one talk to another one. I'll use Al's. No, I will say this about it. We are, first of all, I want to say it. I guess I want to say this more than I want to talk about 2 Chronicles 26. So I am going to stop and say that. I thought about this a lot today. In fact, inordinately, as you'll find out. But spiritual leaders, biblical leaders, are first and foremost servants of Christ. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 4:1, let men so consider us as servants of Christ. That's the way you ought to think about us, servants of Christ. Now, a great deal is said and rightly said about being servant leaders. But I have a little concern about that, that we think that's primarily servants of people. I think it is not. In fact, I think you got a dangerous thing there. We should think of ourselves not primarily as servants of people, but as primarily servants of Christ, right? Now, we talked about character, and neither one of these talks fit your introduction, really, Terry. about character. But, I thought, to get something like this clear puts steel in your backbone. It puts stability in your soul. Let me explain. Again, I know it's not new to you. But 2 Corinthians 4 or 5 says, but we preach not ourselves, but Christ Jesus as Lord, and ourselves your servants for Jesus' sake. Howie Hendricks tells about getting on a plane in Boston. And it was one of these planes with mostly businessmen. The plane was delayed. And the businessmen were irritated, annoyed, aggravating. And he was embarrassed about them. And particularly a guy across the aisle. He was a total pain in the neck. But this flight attendant, this lady, was so gracious, unruffled. And he was amazed at her demeanor in the midst of that situation. So after they finally took off and they got stuff served and he could talk to her, he said, I saw the way you handled that. He said, I want to congratulate you on that. Was something, the way you so graciously and calmly handled that very nettling situation. He said, I would like to write the company and for a commendation. She said, I don't work for American Airlines. And it was an American Airlines plane. Oh, he said, well, who do you work for? She said, I work for Jesus Christ. Tell me about that. Well, I do. I try to serve Jesus Christ in my capacity as a flight attendant. In fact, my husband and I pray about that before every trip. Now, see? For we preach not ourselves, but Christ Jesus is Lord, and ourselves your servants for Jesus' sake. That enables us to serve in the most nettling, aggravating of situations with calmness, assurance, with unreasonable people, without resentment, and without fawning. Christ frees us to serve. So to get it clear, like Paul says, consider us servants of Christ. To consider ourselves first and foremost servants of Christ. And I think a lot of times we have to get ourselves free from people in order to serve them. 1 Corinthians 9:19. Paul said, for though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant unto all. I'm free. And therefore I'm free to serve everybody. I moved into the Trotman home when I was 20. Started to work in the print shop. Doss had come back and, for instance, to check on how I was doing. I'd be feeding envelopes into a hand press, putting them in the box. He'd come along, thumb through the box, pull out one, and the return address was Cattywampus. Hey, Sandy, you know, we've got to have these return addresses straight. And I'll be switched. You could look through that whole box, and that was the only one. That happened time and again in other things. I don't know whether God helped him or the devil. I think it was the devil. And it was characteristic of what I thought was beginning to happen. I'd do 9 things right, 1 thing wrong. What did I hear about? The 1 thing wrong. I get tired of that. Then I memorized Lamentations 3:27, I think it is. It is good for a man to bear the yoke in his youth. And that would last about 2 days, and that would wear off. So, finally, we went to a conference up in Hume Lake, California. And one afternoon, I got on the big boulder. Sat out there, and I said, God, I want to leave. I don't want to take this anymore. I've had enough of this. There are other places to go in this world. And as I fretted and fumed about it, I finally quieted down and then I surrendered. I said, now, Lord, you know, I told you I want to leave. But whatever you show me, I'll do. You know, that afternoon, through a series of scriptures, the Lord showed me that he wanted me to stay. And not only that, to be Dawson's servant. And I said, okay, Lord, I'll do that. I'll stay if it means shining his shoes. And I made that commitment that afternoon. And it freed me in my spirit to serve Doss for Jesus' sake. Without resentment and without fawning. We are first and foremost servants of Christ. Do you need to get free of your supervisor? Get free of the navigators? Or maybe even get free of your team, who sometimes are a threat. And you find yourself getting up in the morning and you're arguing. You're mentally arguing with one of your team members. And you say so-and-so, and they say so-and-so, and you're in a white heat, and there's nobody around but just you. Either combing your hair or shaving or whatever you do at that time in the morning. That's not unusual. You remember 2 Samuel 3:39. What time? I told you it was a little thin. I'll wander a little bit. I have two younger brothers. Next to me, been on fire for the Lord since he's 35. Took off like a rocket, still going. He's almost 70. I've got our youngest brother. And he's only one of two guys, he and his buddy, the only people I've ever heard in my whole lifetime that publicly rejected Christ when he was 18. Today he's writing articles for the Freethinker magazine on why he believes that Bible, Christ, Paul are all fiction. So I've written him, among other things. I said, you know that fiction you talk about so fits life that it's absolutely startling. And I go, I said, you know, it has served me so well for a half a century. After reading your letter, I'm more convinced than ever I'm going to stick with it for the rest of the cruise. And one of the things, this is an illustration of how real life the Bible is. Nobody invented this. Two of David's team had killed a guy who had killed their brother. Now, the brother got killed in battle. The second killing was a murder. And after these two guys on his team killed Abner, then the king said to his men, here's David talking to his king, to his team. Do you not realize that a prince and a great man has fallen in Israel this day? And today, though I am anointed king, I'm the leader of this team, I'm the king, I am weak. Can you imagine admitting that to your team? We're supposed to be always strong. Yeah, if you're leaning on yourself, that's all you got. But if you're serving the Christ, you don't have to put on that kind of a front. If you're hooked in with God, you've got the security to tell it like it is and to admit it, right? He said, hey, I'm the king, but I'm weak. And these sons of Zariah, you know who Zariah was? His sister. My sister's boys, my nephews, are too strong for me. They're too much. I don't know if you ever felt your team was too much for you. I have once in a while. But I've never been afraid of them. Anybody? Because God assured me that years and years ago. So what did he do? I just give it to the Lord. May the Lord handle the situation. May the Lord repay the evildoer for what he's done. He was free. Because he's God's servant. It frees you up inside, doesn't it? So that's why, Alan, I think it's so important. And I wanted to say this, just you need it to be. We are first and foremost servants of Jesus Christ himself. Then we are free to make ourselves servant to others for Jesus' sake. And it takes away that inner turmoil, that resentment of people don't respond and the fear and all that kind of stuff, doesn't it? That's why I say it puts steel in your soul, which leaders need. Because one of my early mentors, I remember shortly after Doss died, was Art Glasser, who later ran the Fuller School of World Missions. He said, Lauren, I'll tell you something. Leadership will always be challenged. Remember, don't forget that. Of course, sometimes it ought to be. That's my other talk, 2 Chronicles 26, which we won't get to. But now let me see. Which notes have I got? Oh, yeah, these right here. You know, it's kind of fun getting older. I can lay a lot of this to age, but it has nothing to do with it. Except that I know with you I can be a little looser, right? A little informal. So, we're servants of Christ. I guess I hammered on that one long enough. But I think it's so important to get that clear. So it grips your soul. Really helps. Then we're stewards of the mission. 1 Corinthians, come back to 1 Corinthians 4, where Paul said, consider us. Here's a way to think about us. We're servants of Christ, and we're stewards of the mysteries of God. We've got a message of which we're stewards. And it's required in stewards that a man be found faithful. So God then gives a mission to his servant. And just to review for you, those mission statements were pretty simple, weren't they? They weren't complicated. For instance, he said to Moses, go to Pharaoh to bring my people out of Egypt. That's simple. But the carrying out of it wasn't all that simple, was it? A lot went into it. Including do a lot of writing. The books of Moses. The desert. All those things. He didn't give them all the details. He said, here's what I want you to do. Simple. But stick with that. So everything related to that happening, didn't it? Joshua, God says, he will lead this people across and will cause them to inherit the land. That's it. David, you will shepherd my people, Israel, and will become their ruler. It's your mission. Apostles, make disciples of all nations. Simple. In stating, a lot of complexities in carrying it out. I think in the navigators, you know, our international aim, you can do it on one hand, five, your thumb and four fingers. It's to multiply laborers in every nation. And this year it'll take between $900 and $100 million. But the mission itself is clear, however we state it. So God gives you, we are stewards of a mission. And I think that alternately blurs and clears in our minds. Now, I don't know about you, it doesn't stay clear all the time, does it for you? Sometimes I wake up in the morning, if my life depended on it, I couldn't tell you what it is. I think I've mentioned to some of you that one time, before Jerry White was going to come and work with me, I was sitting at home and working on my job description. I was splitting it up in two to give, you know, about half to Jerry and the other half. And she said, what are you doing? And I explained it to Lucy. And I said, but you know, I'll tell you something. This morning, if my life depended on it, I couldn't tell you what the purpose of all this is. It's completely blank. So she said, well, when it comes clear, be sure to write it down. It came clear. I wrote it down, and I carry it with me. So I think that's just sort of normal. Now, we've got to be faithful to that mission. You remember Saul's demise? And you remember this, of course, 1 Samuel 15. Samuel said to Saul, 1 Samuel 15, beginning with verse 17, although you were once small in your own eyes, you were once small in your own eyes, now pride's come in. Pride's the great sin. But when you were small in your own eyes, did you not become the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and he sent you on a mission, saying thus and so and thus and so. Why did you not obey the Lord? Oh, he said, I did. I did this, but it was partial. God says, Samuel said in the Lord's behalf, I sent you on a mission. Why didn't you do it? And of course, his excuse later on, I was afraid of the people, so I gave in to them. Verse 24. You got to have it clear in your soul, whose servant are you? You know, for me, the Lord had a rather simple method for me. You know how you train a dog with a choke chain? Well, I felt like the Lord, all those years, had me with a choke chain. And for a long time, the navigators were known as, they've got an anonymous leader. He's not around. We don't see him. In the circles, you know, of evangelical Christianity. That bothered me once in a while. So I'd kind of get off and just try to move off in some of these directions, and the Lord kind of yank on my choke chain. Go. It was as if to say, now, Lauren, I gave you a job, and I intend for you to stick with that. Now somebody else dossed before me. He had a longer rope on him. But on me, tighter rope. Now others would be longer, but God had a mission for me. And as I kept saying, I want you to do that. So I told you at the outset, I'm not that all that virtuous or all that smart. Scrambling for know-how. And on the choke chain. But God helped me. Like he helped you. So, okay. Now we're hammering on that one enough. I don't know, Al. I'm not really trying to avoid questions. I'm really not. You know, I was supposed to quit about now. Let me hurry up on the third thing. See, this is your talk. I'm giving it. Have you given it in the last 5 years?
No, I gave it up.
Did you really?
I lost it.
Well, thank you very much, though. I'll claim it. Would you sign it over to me, and it's mine from here on?
I'm taking it back.
Oh, you're taking it back. Okay. I was going to write a book on it, then, if you could sign it over to me. We are servants of Christ, we are stewards of the mission, and then shepherds of the people God gives to help carry out the mission. People are a gift from God, aren't they? Can you consider your team, your people, for whom you're responsible, as a gift from God? They are, aren't they? Remember before Saul's demise, 1 Samuel 10:26, it says, "And Saul also went home to Gibeah, and there went with him a band of men whose hearts God had touched." God gave him a band of men. And when in the Lord's Prayer there in John 17, he said to the Father, "I have manifested your name to the men you gave me out of the world." People, team members, people are gifts from God. And you know, I learned something from Bob Foster. Bob served on our board of directors for years. And one time at a board meeting, all the NAV staff left. I said, "Bob, I'd like you to just talk with these guys, the non-staff members, and see what they've got to say. Anything they want to say, you chair it." So he wrote me a letter the following week, and I'll never forget what he said. He said, "Lorne, your team is bigger than your staff." He said, "These board members all feel part of your team. You may think of them as non-staff, outsiders, but they feel they're part of your team." And then I began to think about that. The same is true for you. Your team is bigger than your staff. Or take the families. Bob says children. So I thought it was so great that we had the families that wanted to come up at Estes Park. It was super. Donors, they're part of our team. Lauren, how many donors do you think we have, regular donors in the U.S.? Have you ever figured that up? Is it 80, 70,000, 80, 40? Do you have any idea? How many? They're part of the team. You know, it's easy. Of course, Scott Morton and others have helped us greatly to change our attitude on this. But to think, I've got my ministry, then I got to stop my ministry and go over here and raise money. That's part of my ministry. That's part of it. And I have the same goal with these people that I do with my target. Help them grow, help them come to the place where they can labor for Christ and reach others. So I think a lot of times we think too small. And I think as navigators, and in you in your sphere, there are more people probably that want to be a part than you realize. And you've got to think about your leadership responsibilities bigger than just the staff. They're gifts from God as well. Now we've got to shepherd people. Proverbs 27. And you'll see in a moment why I bring this one up. Be sure you know the condition of your flocks. You probably memorized this. Give careful attention to your herds. Pay attention. Shepherd them. For riches do not endure forever, and a crown is not secure for all generations. You are in a place now to shepherd people. It's not going to last forever. So shepherd them now. And do it visibly. That's where you get out from behind the desk and go to where they are. Shepherd them. Now let's see, you don't need that. Nor that. Thank you, Alan, for your outline. And I do give it back to you. And don't be, I would say, get a hold of that thing and run. You've got something there. And it's well-rounded in itself. We are, aren't we, servants of Christ, stewards of a mission, and shepherds of people that God has given to help carry out that mission. So, you know, it's kind of like you do... If you're afraid of the questions that might come, you just keep talking until the time's up. Well, I haven't done that. Did you want to have questions? Should we stand up for a moment first? Let's stand up and stretch. Well, this got a little long. I apologize for that. Yes, well, thank you very much. Very thoughtful, brother. When I came over here, I was thinking of two words when I was walking me driving over here after dinner. For leaders, focus and fire. We need focus and we need fire. Well, I felt that maybe I could help a little bit on the focus. And I think as tired as we are, we won't try to fire anybody up tonight. We'll, now is the time to just take a deep breath and let that come back naturally. Do you have any questions that you want to ask or anything you want to say? Where? My old blood sugar. Oh, thanks. Sorry. Bill, you're right up there big and I couldn't see it. Yes, I think there are. That other message that I almost got in on. Why did Uzziah hit the skids? Two things. When he was strong, his heart was lifted up. It was pride. And because of pride, he thought he could do anything. And he tried to do the work of a priest. And that was sacrilege. Because God had called him to be a king, not a priest. So that can get you off track. The other thing, he was angry. These 80 priests came and talked to him, and they were courageous men, it says, and they tried to convince him he shouldn't do that. And he blew up at him. He was angry. Now, anger, so you got to start with, you're being upset. Lingering anger can grow into resentment, which can deteriorate into bitterness. And you know what the Bible says about bitterness. Looking diligently, lest any man fail the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled, you know, Hebrews 12:15. I think I've seen as many leaders sidetracked, put on the shelf, for bitterness. that ate away inside spoiled them and everything around them as perhaps any other one thing. The other thing is, I'm no psychologist, so I can't give cause and effect here. But sometimes, I don't know what it is, hardens into an inflexibility with leaders. I told some of you on the way up to Dawson's grave the other day that one time I made the mistake of going through all the personnel decisions that I had made, particularly those leaders whose appointment I had approved and whose subsequent removal I also approved. And to my dismay, there were 35 of them. Couldn't believe it. Of course, I've been around a long time. Seemingly forever. And I told you, I got so depressed, I had to go back up there and get some time alone with the Lord about that. That I was such a poor personnel man. Then I reflected on what was it. I think one of the commonalities was that they had what I call delusions of leadership. Certain things they believed that they held inflexibly. And I better not give any specific illustrations. I wish I could, but I don't think I should. But there's got to be flexibility. I can use this. Here's a guy has a great collegiate ministry. And college students respond to his more of a choleric personality. Like the military might even a little better, but they did in this particular country. He had a flourishing ministry. Well, then these students grew up. And they get 25, 26, you still treat them like 19-year-olds. Then they get a little older, and you got to transfer from leading to leading leaders. That's a different thing, isn't it? It's too inflexible. Had to be removed. Still treating them like kids. Or others are absolutely convinced that if we get this, then, well, I'll take one. Relationships. That's the key to all leadership. Yes and no. Or, well, there are others, but I think we've got to have some things that we believe down deep, but we've got to have a lot of flexibility out here as people grow, the situation. So I think inflexibility, the inability to change, flex situations, and still have something solid at the center. I've used the old illustration of a 747. You fly across that, and it's a little rough, and you look out there, and that wingtip is gone about 4 feet. And that's fine. If it doesn't flex, it'll break off. But you don't want that happening at the fuselage. You want that solid. So that's the way I feel we've got that. We've got to have something solid at the center in our lives, like we talked about earlier. Then we got those solid. Then we've got lots of flex out here. So that's something to ask ourselves. I mean, not just about those guys or whoever, but am I flexing like I should?
On the lines of flexibility and the mission, how do you assure that we're all about one work?
You mean the navigators? I don't know if you can. In my latter years, I used to describe myself not as a leader, but as a sheepdog. And a sheepdog tries to get the sheep to go in the general direction together. And if some get off over here, runs around over here, nips on those and gets them back, and then runs around. So I was kind of the sheepdog, that I felt if I could keep him just generally herded in the same direction, I was doing fine. But there's something deeper than that. That is, this is God's work. And except the Lord build the city, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the house, they labor in vain. The watchman waketh in vain. There was a period in there when I was told and unfortunately believed, Lauren, you're the one that, you're really the one guy that can hold this work together. So I stayed up late and got up early and tried to figure out ways to keep this work together, going in the same direction. And I began to wilt into that. And I wanted out. Until Psalm 127:1 finally dawned on me that that is not my job. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain to build it. Except the Lord keep the city, they walk. The watchman waketh in vain. And then these days, I never have a bit of trouble about the navigators. Because I'm very pleased with the direction, with the leadership. But underneath it all thy children should be taught of the Lord, and great shall be the peace of thy children. And I just go to sleep. Don't worry about that. And I learned that God is able to take care of that all by himself. And what helped me to see this is when in the 70s, Jim Peterson and I went around with what we call then the fundamentals of the ministry. And I would talk with people and I would float different mission statements. Some that were off the center. And then I'd watch. And then we'd come back to something and how heads would nod. Yeah, I could see, yeah, that's it. And I could see that the Holy Spirit had been at work in their lives before we ever got there. That shows me it's God's work. So, yeah, unless the Lord holds it together, it's not going to hold together. And I've made some of my quips get me in trouble, but I think it was about the late 70s. Everywhere I went, the navigators were upset. They were disturbed. They were cantankerous. It was awful. And I landed in Australia. I never forget. It was one of the Australians said. They'd heard about it. All over the world, they'd heard about it. The navigator's falling apart. You know, and I found this humor is can be a weakness, not a strength. I said, oh, yeah. Yeah, they've been falling apart ever since I came with them. Well, there's a half-truth there. The tendency is not to hold together, it's to fall apart. Any more than the tendency is for a garden to grow vegetables instead of weeds. It takes some supernatural glue to hold it together. It takes a supernatural force. And I'm convinced that God raised up this work. I'm convinced he's still pleased with it. And when he is no longer, he'll let it go, and he takes his hands off, and we're finished. Oh, it might go on as a shell for a little bit, but the heart and the spirit will be gone. So that's my answer to keeping it going. But I'm very pleased. Every evidence that God himself is teaching and is keeping this work in hand. And so we all have little things that bother us and so on. Of course, we work together with humans. I mean, there have been a few people upset with me and my leadership. Most of the time, one or the other. It's okay. And we'll try to apologize and make it right and go on or hold firm or whatever it needs. But under it all is God. Oh, yeah. We're in good shape.
Mm-hmm. As I get older, the breadth or the number of relationships that I have, whether it be extended family, staff, donors, I feel like I'm failing every relationship. None of them are doing well, just dabbling in all of them.
Yep.
Now,
You know, I was going to leave that out in my talk tonight because I know you're also tired. Because even to say, oh man, you mean I got more than I got now? I can't handle what I got now. Well, let me say one thing. First of all, if it ought to be done, then it can be done. Whatever needs to be done or ought to be done, there is a way to do it. Let's just assure ourselves of that. If it ought not be done, then don't worry about it. But I think there are, you take it in the order of priority. And you start at the center where your highest priority is, the next circle, the next circle, the next circle, next circle. There's higher intensity the closer to the center you get, less intensity out at the end. But take one illustration, for instance. Say you keep in touch with your donors. What, quarterly? Yeah, you don't meet with them once a week. You even write a letter once a week. That's quarterly. And that's probably enough. There are others, perhaps, you might write to extended family once a year. Christmas or New Year's letter. So I think the Lord gives you ideas as how to handle them. And I'll admit to you that the older you get, the more complex it becomes. And I think sometimes Lucy and I are going to move, I don't know, to some place we never heard of in southern Arizona. I think about that for about 2 days, and I think, whoops, I like this much better. But I think that we just have to get to the Lord and say, now, Lord, give me an idea. What should I do? And he's full of ideas. In fact, he doesn't have any problem for ideas. And he can give them to us. John Wesley said, God usually guides me by giving me an idea or ideas I never would have thought of in my own. So when you're perplexed, we ask God for some ideas. In fact, I pray that way. My intercessory prayer life is I start at the center. In fact, I start with myself because I'm the neediest person I know. Then I go to the family, relatives, navigators, and on out in those concentric circles. So I pray priority-wise. It helps me a great deal. Then I'm covering that for which I am most intensely responsible, and less as it goes on up the perimeter. Don't know if that helped any, but it's the way I'm trying to do it. Yes, we have 5 minutes here. I don't know the answer to that question, really. All I know to do is to go back to Ephesians, 5:28. Be angry. That's not wrong. In fact, there are some things we ought to... Anger is a feeling of great displeasure, is it not? And there are more things about which we ought to be displeased, probably, than we are. But what is it when that's out of control? That's the problem. So... Be angry and sin not. Don't let it sin. Let not the sun go down on your wrath. Work out a way to resolve that situation before you go to bed. Don't let the devil get a foothold. I think that means to pray defensively against the devil, who is part of that thing, who's one of the greatest things in my life. I don't know about you. I find they talk about he divides and discourages. He distorts for me. It takes a little thing and makes it so big. And then tries, and I can't get it down again. And I get obsessed with it. And you're awake at night by it. When that happens, well, I find I've got to get a friend and say, I can't handle this by myself. Would you pray with me? You get down on your knees and you pray together. And then you know how it is. It's like letting air out of a balloon. It's amazing. It'll come down to size. It won't disappear because there's a real thing at the core of it, but it gets down to size. So I just think Ephesians 5 is all, is it Ephesians 5 or 4? 4. That's all I know. In fact, I'm working on it now. I'm trying to work out a letter to a relative who's got a problem with that, that's all I know at the moment, in essence. Do you know more? What would you add to that, Daryl? Yeah, right. Okay, we got one more. Then we're, aren't you glad? Pump a little bit here. Okay, one more.
Brian Thatcher.
Here. Brian Thatcher.
Just a question, Warren. You made a statement that one of the mentors mentioned to you about a clear sense of purpose.
Mm-hmm.
You also mentioned the need to get a clear sense of authority.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you've got a theory from that before, but it comes on authority submission relationships and the need of that country is not really today. But I just wonder, where do you have, where do you anchor your conviction for that in the scripture? And when you, how do you feel that's being tied enough by your presence? Now, I wanted to bring it out from it because what I'm picking up off of some of the discussions we have is I sense that what I picked up in those things badly, that there's a sense that people feel somewhat disenfranchised and not having adequate leadership. And I'm wondering if it's anchored to these concerns. So that's one thought there, but I'm more interested where you would anchor that from the scripture. I think I know, but I'd like to hear you reiterate that.
Well, yeah, you're right. At 2 minutes to 9, there isn't one place that I anchor this, but rather from the general tenor of scripture. But I would just say we live in an ordered universe where there is authority and submission to authority, beginning with God and what He has delegated. And it goes on from there. And I think the reason about this matter that authority is a touchy subject is because we've realized that human beings so tendency toward tyranny if they've got it, but also a tendency toward anarchy if they don't have it. And so that started back in Genesis 3. And my attempts on the subject were to face those realities, and then how do you resolve that? So it goes back to the basic problem of authority, which is sin. So there's reason to be afraid of it. But also, as I said, all leadership would be challenged. So that's all. I think I would just stop there. But it starts with God Himself in the ordered universe in which there is authority and submission to authority. And God has delegated that in various settings. And it has to be exercised according to scriptural guidelines, and when they are, work smoothly. When it doesn't, there's conflict and war. Okay, well, thank you very much. It's good to be with you.